From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital in Dallas, but we do not know to where he has proceeded. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States.
Hello, this is Jerry Pippin, and I wanted to make a few comments on the JFK assassination. 50 years is coming up like a speeding bullet, and all of a sudden, all the media everywhere, radio and television, magazines, newspapers, they're doing their regular hindsight, looking back 50 years to the JFK assassination. The interesting thing about this, in my opinion, well, it's actually two things. One thing is political. Let me mention that first. The JFK assassination and the theories, the hypothesis that it was a cover-up, is one thing that really crosses political lines. You end up getting lots of conservative Republicans and lots of liberal Democrats on the same page. You know, it's not unusual. 61%, according to a survey taken last week, still think that the JFK assassination was a cover-up done by more than one person, not just Lee Harvey Oswald, or maybe not even Lee Harvey Oswald at all. It's according to who you ask. But 61% is a pretty good percentage, especially 50 years later, when the establishment has had all these years to cover their tracks and try to get things in order. Of course, the problem, as we know, and we've been doing these series of shows, is that it's a nightmare when it comes to credibility. I mean, first of all, you got the autopsy, the photographs of being burned in the fireplace of the naval doctor who did it. Is saying basically that he didn't want to get the hypothesis going by the people who believe that there was something going on besides the official story. In other words, he was saying that he destroyed the evidence to protect the evidence. Sound familiar? Somewhat like government talk several times. A language that only doublespeak in America is practiced by bureaucrats. Now, when we talk about the JFK assassination, I find it incredible that even though, for instance, in this show, we're going to feature some comments by Bob Schieffer and others on CBS News, even by the comments that lay open the case that maybe we didn't get the real story, we have Bob Schieffer here saying, well, he believes Lee Harvey Oswald did it. He was a lone gunman. Why do I believe that? It's an interesting theory that I have, and I'm going to present it to you, and you can either throw it out the window or mull on it, or, as we say, chew on it. But when we talk about the different theories, you got to remember Bob Schieffer is a member of the CBS News establishment, even though he's a great reporter, and I admire him quite a lot. And then a little earlier this year, we talked a little bit about the fact that Jim Lehrer on PBS, he believes that there was a lone gunman, and it was Lee Harvey Oswald as well. Well, I want to present something to you that you may not have thought about. Bob Schieffer and Jim Lehrer, both are highly respected journalists, but they, guess what? They're both from Texas, and not from just the state of Texas. They're from right where it happened, where the dirty mark against Dallas was presented in the case for the assassination of JFK. And even though Lee Harvey Oswald was as far from being a right-winger as you can get, there were many people in Dallas that were quite respected, including H.L. Hunt, Clint Murchison of the Dallas Cowboys, and many others who evidently had something to do with it. They were over at Clint Murchison's house the night before the assassination. Lyndon Johnson shows up there, and all of a sudden everybody's quiet. It's like a church mouse. And nobody's making any noise. And then as soon as Lyndon leaves, all heck breaks loose again, and the party begins again. So what was the party about? What was happening here? We only have circumstantial evidence. Most of the people by now have gone on to meet the maker, and the graveyard is full of those people. But the fact is that they left behind a legacy, and the legacy was something that was hard to live down for Dallas. First of all, Dallas was a right-wing bed of hyperbole, and some of it even got a little past that. And we're talking about 50 years ago, and I guess nothing's changed, huh? If you stop and look at the Dallas of today and how they treat Obama. The fact is that these two reporters, Jim Lehrer and Bob Cooper, are well-respected men. I'm not accusing them of anything other than perhaps a hidden bias that they don't even recommend or recognize, and that is a fact. That they're from Dallas, from that area, from Fort Worth, and they don't appreciate all of the innuendos that were happening at the time. And remember, I was in San Francisco during this event, and out there, most people were convinced that Dallas, Texas, was a hotbed of right-wing fanatical reactionaries, and that they were guilty of murder of the president. And this really hasn't changed in over 50 years. So listen to this interview and this roundtable discussion, and I think you'll find that, first of all, some incredible stuff that Bob Cheever's dug up, thanks to CBS News. He is able to come up with some pretty good witnesses. Plus, thanks to the idea that he was there on the scene as a reporter, worked with the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, and knew where the other reporters were and what they really thought. And we give Bob Cooper five stars for bringing all the facts forward, but I give him two stars or one star, and the same as I did James Jim Lehrer, when you talk about objectivity. There has to be something wrong when they just overlook blandly facts that are coming to light that show that the Warren Commission was dysfunctional, that we didn't get the information correct, nobody got the information correct, nobody made an effort to cover it up because it was covered up naturally by the people that were involved. And so you take all this into account and listen to this interview, and remember, I respect Bob Cheever, and I respect the job that CBS News is doing, but when they say that the evidence is there that Lee Harvey Oswald did it, I don't know what evidence they're looking at. All the evidence I've seen shows that there must have been something else going on. And we have over 100 books written by 100 researchers. Not all of them are just efforts to cash in on a big-time story with some stretching of the facts. Some of them are pretty good, objective reports. And so I submit to you, listen to this with a jaundiced eye, or in this case, a jaundiced ear, as you listen to these reporters trying to rationalize, and they did fairly successfully, that Lee Harvey Oswald did it. We weren't fed a line of you-know-what and by the authorities, and that we got the story correctly. Well, I submit to you that we didn't get the story correctly at all. We're about 180 degrees wrong. And if you want to find out what I really think about it, go over to jerrypippin.com, click on the JFK banner on the Conspiracy Files, and you can hear several shows that I've done about it over the years. Thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks for considering my side of the story. And now let's listen to the mainstream story. And everybody should be proud of Bob Schieffer here, as he did the mainstream up well.
Arrived in Argentina in 1983 to cover the war with Great Britain over the Falkland Islands. I was told Argentina had no reliable history. Each of the country's leaders had rewritten history to play up his accomplishments and play down or eliminate whatever his predecessor had accomplished, a frequent habit of totalitarian leaders. In the days after Oswald shot the president, the first reaction of many in Dallas was to bulldoze this building as if that might somehow erase the whole thing and the fact that it had happened here. Instead, community leaders decided to make it into a museum and a center for scholarship about one of America's most terrible weekends. They recognize that a democracy requires an accurate history, without which we cannot understand how we came to be what we are. There had been threats of demonstrations and even violence from scattered right-wing hate groups before Kennedy came to Dallas, but his reception in every city, including Dallas, was overwhelmingly friendly. The man who shot him was anything but a right-wing zealot. He was an itinerant loner, a loser, and a failure who had defected to the Soviet Union. He was not from Dallas or of Dallas. Yet for years, in the minds of many, it was somehow Dallas's fault. It was not. And the sixth-floor museum at Dealey Plaza has helped us understand that. We may never understand why Oswald did it, but the assassination could have happened in any city in America. Back in a minute.
Welcome back to Face the Nation. Joining us now, Thurston Clark, the author of JFK's Last 100 Days, CBS News contributor Douglas Brinkley, and the University of Virginia's Center for Politics, Larry Sabato. Doug Brinkley, beyond this tragedy, why was this such an important anniversary for America?
Well, I think a lot of people are remembering where they were, what I did that day. This was brought to us live on television. You were playing clips of Walter Cronkite. Well, everybody was turning into Cronkite. What's going on? Not just John F. Kennedy died, but who did it? Then who is Lee Harvey Oswald? Who's Jack Ruby? Why is Jackie Kennedy still wearing a pink Chanel suit with blood? Where's Lyndon Johnson? On and on and on for 4 days, everybody kind of tuned in. And there's a line by Bob Dylan who once said, people don't live or die, people just float. Most people live pretty flatline lives, but when Kennedy was killed, they weren't floating anymore. It was like real-time adrenaline for the whole country.
And, you know, I mean, those of us who were here and covered this story, I think the part that is not really understood today is that beyond this tragedy that we saw unfolding on television, and we'd never seen anything like this before, hanging over all this, it was like we all felt on 9/11. We didn't know what it meant. We didn't know if this was the beginning of World War III. We were a year away from the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was just this profound, I can't understand this. Why is this happening? And I think, in a sense, that America was never quite the same as it was after that day. Thurston Clark, your book focuses so much on Kennedy's last 100 days. Why do you think that period was so important?
Because finally, in that period, he was addressing the two great threats to our nation, a nuclear war and racial conflict. You know, at the inauguration, Robert Frost wrote a poem that he couldn't deliver because of the glare from the sun. The last words were, a golden age of poetry and power, of which this noonday is the beginning hour. There was poetry in Kennedy's first 2 years, but he didn't marry poetry to power until finally, in June, he gave two very important speeches. The first, American University speech, proposing a test ban treaty. The second, speech about race, in which he announced he was finally sending a civil rights bill to Congress.
Yeah, because race had not been all that important to him,
no.
Or at least publicly. He did not mention it in his inauguration address. He was against James Meredith enrolling at Ole Miss. Yeah. He urged him not to do it. He was against the March on Washington, sponsored by Martin Luther King.
He was originally against it because the march was going to be at the Capitol, and he was afraid it would make it seem as if they were trying to intimidate Congress. So he and Bobby Kennedy were, through negotiations, they moved it down to the Lincoln Memorial. But what you said is right. Kennedy was very disappointing to the civil rights leaders on civil rights. But when he gave this marvelous speech on the 11th, at that time, Martin Luther King turned to a companion and said, "Can you believe that white man not only stood up to the plate, he hit it over the ballpark, out of the ballpark."
And Larry, one of the nuggets in your new book that I found so interesting, the story of how Jackie Kennedy called the Civil War historian James Robertson the night of the assassination to ask for help putting together her husband's funeral.
It really impressed me enormously when I first heard this, and I decided to stress it in the Kennedy Half Century because I think one of the less well-known stories and less told stories is how Jackie Kennedy helped the country get through this, and somehow in the midst of her shock and grief, even on the flight back from Dallas, she was already planning to have a Lincoln-esque funeral for her husband and to create the myth of Camelot. She was thinking about his legacy. When she was told about Lee Harvey Oswald, she said he didn't even have the opportunity to die for civil rights. It had to be some silly little communist. She wanted to convert his legacy into something bigger, and she did.
But she actually tried to replicate in the White House how it had looked when Lincoln's casket had brought
that. Yes, that historian was called by the White House and told to go over to the Library of Congress and get all the information he could about Lincoln's funeral. The first thing he said was, "In the meantime, you get all the black bunting you can find." He went over to the Library of Congress. They didn't have the lights on. They couldn't find the light switches. They used flashlights, and they found old Harper's Weekly from 1865. He dashed over to the White House. He got there in a sea of black bunting with a team of carpenters already ready to construct the Lincoln East Room affair, just as it had been in 1865.
And Doug, you, of course, wrote the wronderful biography of Walter Cronkite. This was a day that not only changed the country, it changed television. It changed the way we get information. Up until this point, most people got their news from print.
Absolutely.
And this, nothing like this had ever happened before.
No, in the 50s, you had the Kefauver, you know, hearings being brought on TV. Well, that's just Congress's sausage making. And certainly John Glenn's Triple Orbit started bringing people into special effects television. But bringing a real-life trauma like this, hour after hour after hour, with all those poignant moments, including the young Kennedy children there at Arlington National Cemetery, and Jackie Kennedy looking so almost Madonna-like, or almost that every time you see that photo of her with the veil, it's just the most gripping drama. And as you mentioned, after that, Vietnam becomes the television war, and Watergate's brought on TV, and we're all turned into these big events and followed them through. The Kennedy assassination began that.
As horrible as it was, I mean, I think what it hit people even harder because they had come to believe, did they not, Thurston, that they knew the Kennedys better than they'd known any of his predecessors simply because of television.
Well, exactly. And Kennedy gave a live televised news conference on average every 16 days. It's extraordinary now if you compare it to what's happened since. You know, the other thing is that again and again you read people saying, "I knew him as if he was my brother, as if he was my son." Charles de Gaulle said afterwards, "They're crying all over France as if he was a Frenchman, a member of their families." I mean, de Gaulle was stunned by this reaction.
And he was, and still, in my view, was the best there ever was at television and knowing how to use it and how to communicate on television.
All presidents try to imitate John F. Kennedy, but they can't. He had a special magic, a special combination of rhetorical ability, the ability to inspire, and also self-deprecating humor, which some of our presidents really ought to acquire.
But you know, the interesting thing is he didn't like television that much. When he came to the White House, he had all of the sets pulled out, and he left one with rabbit ears so Caroline could watch Lassie.
I must say, I never knew that. Why do you think it is, and I'll put the question to all three of you, today 61% of the American people still believe that Lee Harvey Oswald did not act alone. I think the evidence is overwhelming that he did. I've always tried to keep an open mind about these various conspiracy theories, but it, as yet, no one has shown me evidence to convince me that there was anybody else connected. Why do you think that is, Larry?
People looked at this as one of the most terrible things that had ever happened in American history, and it was. It was so big. How could you balance it with a loser, a total loser who had failed at everything, as Lee Harvey Oswald had? There had to be more meaning in it, and they've tried to invest it with meaning by saying it's the CIA, it's the anti-Castro Cubans, it's LBJ, it's this one, it's that one. But as you say, you have to go by the evidence, and we're still waiting for evidence beyond that of Lee Harvey Oswald, who clearly was guilty.
Well, there's no question that the administration was using every means they could. They wanted to kill Castro, and they were sending sabotage missions in there. Castro knew about that. But, again, there is no evidence that he ever acted on it. In fact, he later said in an interview, I would always want a second source when I hear something from Castro. But he said, I'm smarter than that, basically. He said they would have obliterated this island if I had done something like that.
Look, it's clear Lee Harvey Oswald killed John F. Kennedy. And you ask why people wonder. I interviewed Gerald Ford at Rancho Mirage once for a book, and I was asking about NATO and the fall of Saigon and his presidency. And he said, come here. He said, look at this. And it was a little stack like this. He said, this is my incoming about my presidency. Now, you see this stack? It was like towering. He said, that was about me and the Warren Commission and why I invented a magic bullet. And, you know, I think it gets down to the Warren Commission report. I think it was in time sloppy. It was rushed. But it was right in the end. And maybe on this 50th anniversary, we need to thank people, the legacies of Gerald Ford and John McCloy and Erland Specter and people that worked so hard on those multiple volumes, because they, I think, nailed the story.
What do you think, Thurston, that John Kennedy's real legacy is?
Oh, first of all, that he was the first Catholic elected president. I mean, he kicked open the door. After him came a whole bunch of other minorities. He appointed the first Polish American to his cabinet, John Grunowski. He wrote a book about immigration called A Nation of Immigrants, very important to him. The other is, of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis. If Kennedy hadn't been president, I don't wonder if we'd be sitting here right now, if there'd be a Dallas. I mean, his role in that was absolutely crucial. And he realized it, too, afterwards at a press conference. You know, he'd been the only one who didn't want to have a retaliatory strike. At a press conference afterwards, he refers to Abraham Lincoln, asks his cabinet to vote. Lincoln's cabinet, they say 12 ayes. Lincoln says, I vote nay. The nays win. That had to be on his mind.
Thank you all very much on this very special weekend in American history. We'll be back in 1 minute. Hugh Ainsworth, who covered the assassination for the Dallas Morning News, he has a new book out called November 22nd, 1963, Witness to History. Mike Cochran, who covered it for the Associated Press here in Dallas and in Fort Worth. And Dr. Ronald Jones, now head of the surgery at Baylor University. He back then was chief surgical resident at Parkland Hospital. Hugh, I want to start with you because you were one of the few people who saw President Kennedy being shot. You later were there when Lee Harvey Oswald was shot, and you also were there when Lee Harvey Oswald was captured at the Texas Theater. What was this like when these shots rang out? You were just not far from where we are right now in Dealey Plaza.
Within seconds, it was complete pandemonium. People were throwing their children down, protecting them. People were running into each other. People were screaming and crying. It was just the most hectic thing you could imagine.
And it was such a contrast because people had been so happy at all this. Mike Cochran, you were the AP guy in Fort Worth. You worked out of the newsroom of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, where I was a reporter. It had gone very well in Fort Worth.
Oh, it had gone beautifully. The people of Fort Worth, the welcome, it was just amazing. They obviously adored the president and Jacqueline, and it was really heartwarming. And it was the people at the Hotel Texas, both outside and inside, were just seemed to be beside themselves. And it was really quite a moving episode.
Well, I remember the reporters who were there and covered him, and you were there. You were kind of relieved when the story moved to Dallas.
Yes, I left the Hotel Texas and went to Carswell and phoned what was the final wheels up bulletin for President Kennedy when the plane took off for the short hop to Dallas. I walked back. When I got back to the office, I walked through the newsroom of the Star-Telegram, and as I passed the news desk, I kind of stopped and quipped, and I said, "Well, we got him out of, boys, we got him out of town safely."
Yeah.
Went into my office. I sat down at my desk, and just minutes later, a copy boy screamed. He'd torn some copy off the Associated Press printer, and he screamed, "The president's been shot."
Yeah. You know, Doctor, you were at Parkland Hospital there. We didn't know what had happened. What? How did you feel when you got word of this?
I had just finished an operative procedure that morning and gone down to the cafeteria to have lunch, and the page operator began to call people's staff, respond immediately, including the chief of surgery, who I knew was out of town. And I called the operator, and I said, "Why are you paging everyone's staff?" And she said, "Dr. Jones, the president's been shot, and they're bringing him to the emergency room, and they need physicians right away." And so Dr. Perry and I ran out the back of the cafeteria, down the hall, down steps, and to the emergency room and into trauma room one. And Mrs. Kennedy was on the left of the door. As I entered, the president was on a stretcher, arms out on arm boards. And I noticed a small hole in the front of the neck that I estimated to be about a quarter of an inch. And I knew he had a large wound in the back of his head, the extent of which I wasn't sure because we hadn't examined him that closely. And Dr. Carrico was trying to get an airway going, and Dr. Perry decided he would do a tracheotomy, and I would do a cut down in the upper arm.
And he was alive at that point, but just barely.
Dr. Carrico thought he had seen some attempts at respiration. Whether that was true or just a neurologic response, I don't know. When I saw him, he was motionless, his eyes were open, he was staring, and I never saw any evidence of life as such. But nevertheless, we decided to try to do something rather than do nothing, because occasionally you can get somebody brought back. But we didn't know the extent of that brain injury at that time.
All right, we're going to take a break here, and then we're going to come back and talk about what happened after that in a minute. Now, Hugh Ainsworth, you had been there in Dealey Plaza and saw this happen. And then you were in the police station that morning when Oswald was shot. Tell us a little bit about what that was like.
Well, you know, I was somewhat concerned because there had been many death threats through the night. And when I got up and found out they had moved him, I was amazed. I grabbed my wife and I said, "We've got to get down there." So we ran like the devil for the police station. I got in just a very few minutes before they brought him out. Now, I did not see Ruby. I was probably 3 or 4 feet people behind. But all of a sudden, we heard this pop. And just it was almost like being the first day, 2 days later, because everyone went wild. And there were so many international reporters there. They were speaking different languages and pushing and shoving. And you know, they had those huge cameras in those days. And everybody was getting bumped around. But it was a good while before we knew it was Ruby.
You had known Jack Ruby, did you not, or knew of him?
I had known him for about 3 years.
Why do you think he did it?
I think he wanted to be somebody. He was quite a show-off. He was not a nice man. He had a huge temper. And I'd see him at the newspaper every week, a couple of times. He was a groupie for newsmen and cops.
Mike, what happened? You were back in Fort Worth. You had no idea of coming to Dallas, did you?
Not in the beginning, but the after we heard the president had been shot, well, my wife had dropped me off after we'd gone to Carsville. So I didn't have a car, but I jumped in with a bunch of Star Telegram writers and photographers and just headed over to Parkland.
But the most amazing thing that happened to you was the burial of Lee Harvey Oswald, where you actually became a pallbearer, as it were, in that funeral, you and three reporters from the Star Telegram. Tell us how that happened.
Well, it was at Rose Hill Cemetery in Fort Worth, and of course I was based in Fort Worth. And so I was assigned to cover it. We'd gotten the tip the night before. I was in Dallas, in the Dallas Bureau the night before, after Oswald had been killed. But we got a tip that there would be the funeral in Fort Worth the next day. And so when I showed up, of course, there were nobody there. I mean, we were early. They delivered the casket. The police escort delivered the casket about 1:30. And but as the day went on, you know, there were no mourners there.
Yeah. And so how did it happen? The funeral home operator said, somebody's got to help us get this casket out of the hearse.
Well, if we were waiting, you know, one of the strangest things, at about 3 o'clock, somewhere around 3 o'clock, a rumor started that the casket was empty. That there was nobody in that casket, and if there was anybody in that casket, it was not Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yeah.
And so caused such a stir that the police chief, Cato Hightower, and a couple of officers went into the little chapel, checked, and came back out and assured us that at least Oswald was.
But you and the reporters carried the casket out to the gravesite.
That's right.
Doctor, let me ask you, were called back to the emergency room when they brought Lee Oswald. Was he alive when he got there?
He was alive when he got there. There were four of us that got to trauma room two, which is where Governor Connally had been, and he did have a heartbeat. And he had been shot in the left chest and had major vascular injuries. As Jack Ruby shot him, he turned like this, and that caused a lot of more of injuries than if he'd taken the shot straight on. But same thing. I did a cut down in the upper arm, just as I had in the president, and inserted a chest tube. And we had him to surgery within about 10 minutes after he came to the emergency room. And he lived almost roughly an hour and 20 minutes before he expired on the table.
But he said nothing.
He said nothing. He was unconscious, much as the president looked, but he had a heartbeat and was alive when he came to the emergency room.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us this morning, and we'll be back in a
The story broke on the United Press wire. Merriman Smith had the first flash traveling with the group going through Dealey Plaza. And when that bulletin flash came on the air, Eddie Bliss, our editor, happened to be right at the machine. I was at my desk a few feet away. And he yelled that there was shooting in Dallas. Well, right away, I run to the machine, and we start shouting to everybody else, "Hey, the Kennedy's been shot!" And right away, we hoped for television. We realized it wasn't possible. Ran into an adjoining room, and Eddie started feeding the press service bulletin to me, which I was digesting, reading on the air, and they. You know, waved me back into the news desk the minute they had the televisions hot. I saw them wheeling them into the newsroom, and they got me back. The intensity with which we were doing the job was indicated by the fact that I didn't get off the air for 5 hours, didn't leave the desk. When I did, I realized I was in shirt sleeves. Well, not long before that, Frank Stanton let the word pass that he didn't like to see his correspondents in shirt sleeves. And here I was in shirt sleeves, one of the most important broadcasts of all time. My secretary had been told to bring my jacket out. She'd put it on the back of the chair, and perhaps she'd told me it was there. But those words just passed through my head. I had far more important things to think about.
Well, during a long interview I had with Mr. Johnson at the LBJ Ranch in September 1969, We talked about the Kennedy assassination. A portion of the interview was not broadcast at the president's request on the grounds, he said, of national security. I asked Mr. Johnson then whether he was satisfied there was no international conspiracy in his assassination.
I can't honestly say that I've ever been completely relieved of the fact that there might have been international connections.
You mean you still feel that there might have been?
Well, I have not completely discounted.
Well, that would seem to indicate that you don't have full confidence in the Warren Commission report.
No, I think the Warren Commission study, and I think, first of all, is composed of the ablest, most judicious, bipartisan men in this country. Second, I think they had only one objective, and that was the truth. And third, I think they were competent and did the best they could. But I don't think that they are, me or anyone else, is always absolutely sure of every thing that might have motivated Oswald or others that could have been involved.